Welcome to Get Over It, the Intuitive Transformation Podcast for Exceptional 21st Century Living. We have got a really great show tonight. We have a show on Navajo mysticism, and we're going to be speaking with Charles Langley, and we're going to talk about his book, Spirit Land, The Peyote Diaries of Charles Langley. This is an excellent book, story written in form. You're going to absolutely love the book, and you're going to love our conversation. Now, the information shared on Get Over It uses intuitive and pragmatic insight to help you break through the blocks and release energy that is no longer needed. Yes, we're going to help you release your BS that is holding you back. But folks, I always ask that real question, are you really ready to? And by the way, BS is belief system, so let's raise our frequency here and get into belief system mode. Now, a bit about me for my new listeners, intuitive since birth. I'm a third-generation intuitive with over 3 decades of experience helping people break through the blocks along their path. I'm a strategist for personal and professional transformation, revealing information which enables you to become a master builder of your life. I spent 25 successful years in corporate America as an executive sales professional, and I am the founder of Healing Visions Ministries and the Northern California Children's Education Network, a 501c3 nonprofit. I authored Getting Your M&Ms, the Men and Money book, and Masterful Choices, the Key to Easy, Effective Change. I provide consultations and healings regarding relationships, business, career, money, and love that heal the mind-body-spirit connection, allowing you to live your life to the fullest. And my clients tell me that I keep it real while providing them with accurate information to assist them along their journey as a spirit living a human existence. But they also say, if you really don't want to know, don't ask Monique. My background includes a doctorate in metaphysics, Reiki master teacher, ordained minister, and clinical hypnotherapist. So whether you are stressed, depressed, or possessed, I can help. To find out more about me and the services I offer, visit my website, MoniqueChapman.com. And I do invite you to like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter and LinkedIn, and you can always sign up for my opt-in newsletter, Intuitive Living, from my website, and that's MoniqueChapman.com. Charles Langley is the former news editor at the London Evening Standard, Europe's best-selling evening paper. Raised in England, he set out across the United States in 2003 to drive from Florida to California, but wound up on a Navajo reservation in Arizona. At a peyote medicine ceremony, he met a shaman named Blue Horse. After earning a degree in anthropology at the University of New Mexico in 2007, he became Blue Horse's apprentice and began compiling an archive of the workings of Navajo traditional medicine. Now, Charles and his wife, who's a nuclear physicist, they live in New Mexico. Welcome, Charles.
Well, thank you for having me on the show, Monique. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you on. Now, folks, again, the title of the book is Spirit Land, The Peyote Diaries of Charles Langley. Excellent book. A lot of fun to read. A lot of medicine, if you will, being shared. Medicine in quotes being shared in the book. Charles, you know, you have such a varied background. I mean, you were in England, you came to the States, landed in Florida, and then you decided to take a road trip. What brought that on?
Well, I've been an international journalist for more than 30 years, I think. And I've been the night news editor of the Evening Standard for getting on for 10 years by that time. And I just reached that stage in life where I felt that really I needed a change. And I read somewhere, I can't remember where I read it now, but someone suggested that every 10 years you should rip up your life and start again. But I'd sort of left it a bit late, I thought, after 30. But anyway, that's basically what I did. I resigned, I quit. And I'd always had this sort of bizarre idea in the back of my head that one day I'd drive across the United States. So I flew to Florida, I bought a car in Florida, and I set out to drive to San Francisco, where I had a friend of mine, an English friend of mine. He was a professor at the university there. But along the way, I landed in Albuquerque. And there I met some people, one of whom well, they're all Navajo Indians, but I ended up, to cut a very, very long story short, I ended up going to some medicine meetings with these people. Mm-hmm. And from then on, things began to grow. Now, I don't want to give anyone the impression that I bowled into New Mexico, you know, one day, and the next day I was a Navajo medicine man's apprentice. It took a very long time, actually. It took a number of years. Uh-huh. And in fact, the Spirit Land, the Paoli Diaries, is my second book. The story is actually so complicated that I wrote another book about it, which is the first one, which is called Meeting the Medicine Men.
Okay.
To cut this down to its barest essentials, I began to go to medicine meetings, and I went to medicine meetings in Mexico. I went to Canada. I went to various tribal meetings in the United States. But it took a long time before I met Blue Horse.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably a couple of years before I met him. By this time, I'd met a number of medicine men, and I'd actually, well, to say I'd worked with, there has been many exaggeration, but I had been going around with these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, one of them just turned to me, and he said, and this is a paraphrase, I want to be very honest with you, your listeners, this is
okay.
A paraphrase, but essentially okay. What he said was, look, you may not know this, but you're one of us. We can see it in you. And if you're able to stay here, I'm sure, you know, somebody will show you our traditional ways.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that sounded like, you know, an offer I wasn't going to get twice in my life. So, I thought that was a very good idea, because when he said it, it sort of made sense to me. I'd been a medical journalist for a long time, actually,
mm-hmm.
and it was a kind of, healing is a kind of area that comes very naturally to me. It's a natural sort of thing that I feel when I'm doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I bumped into Blue Horse a number of times, and he sort of ummed and ahed and, you know, said, well, you can come and watch what I do, you know, just once. And it was, well, maybe twice. But it was months before I actually went with him. At one point, I was actually living at his place in a tent outside his house, and he kept saying, well, I'll take you, and then, you know, something had happened, and he wouldn't. But when we actually started working together, I mean, it was such an easy fit. We got on so well together that it just kind of rolled on, you know, and at first I should tell you, I wasn't his apprentice to start with. I was bag carrier and chauffeur for most of the time.
Oh, okay.
I used to drive him around the reservation to various places, and carry his bags, and one of the things he takes with him is this, and I'll explain this as we go, but it's a kind of traveling fireplace, because when he works, he does a lot of divination work, and to do that, you need these red-hot charcoals, and they need to be brought into the middle of the house,
mm-hmm.
which was fine in the days when Navajos lived in traditional hogans, which is a sort of wood structure with an earth floor. That was fine, but not many Navajo housewives want you dumping red-hot embers on her carpet, you know, I mean, it's not really the kind of thing people want.
Yeah, I would appreciate it.
No, yeah, exactly. So he has this kind of traveling fireplace, which I have to carry, right? And this thing, but it's full of sand, you know, to sort of protect it. It weighs about 60 pounds, you know, so I'm struggling with this thing, and I'm carrying his bags and so on and so forth. And but eventually things settled down, and he turned to me one day and said, you know, I'm going to give you certain things. I'm going to adopt you into my family,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to be my apprentice. So I said, terrific. I said, great. That'll be great. Mm-hmm. And so it rolled on from there. But, you know, like I said, I don't want to give anybody the impression that you can rock up on the Navajo reservation one day, find somebody and become an apprentice. It takes a very long time for people to accept you.
Well, I think that it would. I mean, they've kept a clear, well, for the most part, the people who are truly into the Navajo ways, they've kept it clean and clear of most modern things that we have in our world today. So they can tap back into the old world, if you will, to their old habits very easy. And I would imagine they just don't want to give that information away.
Well, yes. I mean, that's true. And I should say, for any Navajos who may be listening in, there's nothing in the book that gives away any sacred secrets. I mean, I do talk about what medicine men do, and I describe what happens. But, you know, the essential things in a ceremony, the songs and so on, which are a vital part of it, the prayers, are just not there. I mean, you know. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't even be possible for me to record them, really. It's not something you could do. So there's no secrets given away. Mm-hmm. But I think what I have managed to do, and this, you see, one of the things that's going on here, and you just mentioned this about, you know, the Navajos having been able to keep their traditions clear and true.
Mm-hmm.
They have. And one of the reasons for this is that they've generally been very resistant in many ways to outside influences. I mean, the first white people didn't really begin to appear in the Southwest. I mean, I'm not talking about some people of Spanish descent, but you know, immigrants coming in from the East, you know, uh-huh. piling into America uh-huh. and moving steadily west, uh-huh. didn't really sort of start to make an impact here until really the 1850s, 1860s. By the 1870s, after some very traumatic experiences, the Navajos had been put on a reservation. The reservation just expanded. I mean, they were brilliant at sort of getting land back on the grounds that white people didn't think it was worth anything. You know, just thought it was mm-hmm. desert, but to mm-hmm. Navajos, it was vital land. And they managed to put together a reservation which is bigger than a lot of European countries. I mean, it's bigger than the Republic of Ireland, it's bigger than Belgium, it's bigger than Holland, you know, bigger than Denmark. Mm-hmm. It's a big slab of land.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were able, really, to keep a lot of influences out, which means that the language is still pretty strong. Most Navajos over about 40 will speak Navajo. And the traditions are strong. But mm-hmm. there's another factor here which I wanted to mention, if I may.
Oh, please do.
It's not just that the traditions are strong, it's that they are pure. The medicine men I work with are mostly pretty old now. I mean, Blue Horse is 76, I think, this year. He's not quite sure when he was born, but anyway, we're voting for 76 this year.
Okay.
And so are most of the other medicine men. But you see, he learned his medicine really in the 1940s, 50s,
mm-hmm.
of men of a similar age to himself, right, which takes you back into the 1800s. Well, the guys who taught him learned their medicine off men who learned their medicine from men who learned it before the white men ever got here. So, I mean, mm-hmm. this is only a three-generation chain. So it's a very short chain. So the medicine and the traditions come through very purely among the Navajo. Mm-hmm. But they're also very old. Now, you mentioned I'm an anthropology grad. And mm-hmm. the reason I did an anthropology degree while I was being Blue Horse's apprentice, which I still am, by the way, was I didn't want people to think that I was some aging hippie, you know, sitting in a teepee, eating peyote and having visions, you know, and I was actually there for a purpose. But I wanted to put some sort of scientific structure if you like, on what I was learning from the Navajos. I wanted, you know, to be able to talk knowledgeably, if you like, to about what some of I was some of that which I was learning, you know, where it may have come from and what it really meant. Mm-hmm. And certainly, I think now, and I'm never going to be able to prove this, but I think there's a good case to be made that the Navajo traditions that we're witnessing today not only go back thousands of years, they may well go back to the Ice Age. I mean, there's no reason to think there hasn't been a direct transmission for many, many thousands of years, and that could well take us back to the last Ice Age.
Most definitely. Most definitely. Well, folks, we're speaking with Charles Langley. He is the author of Spirit Land, The Peyote Diaries of Charles Langley. And the book is available everywhere, so do go out and get it. The book is a fast-paced book, and it's very intriguing to read. It grabs your attention right away. To me, it's like a Stephen King novel, because I like Stephen King. So, you just read on. But at the same time, you're exploring this wonderful world of the Navajo. And quite frankly, I wasn't aware of the Navajo ways at all. And I found out that there's a part of the Navajos are very keen right now on making sure that the children, if you will, learn the language so that it can carry on. Is that correct, Charles?
Well, yes and no. There have been moves to try and strengthen the language, but regrettably, they are not being very successful. As I said, most older Navajos, that's Navajos over about 40, 45, will speak Navajo, and very often as a first language. I mean, people like Blue Horse, English is very much a second language to him. You know, his first language is Navajo. I wouldn't go as far as to say I can speak Navajo. I understand quite a lot of Navajo, but trying to speak it, if you're an English speaker, particularly if you've got an English accent like mine, it's almost impossible to get your mouth around some of the sounds. But actually, I mean, to come back to your point, the language has been very, very strong up until now. I mean, when I first came here 15 years ago, it was reckoned something like 76% or 78% of Navajo spoke Navajo. Today it's down to 30%. And although moves are being made to try to keep the language going, in the kindergartens, I was reading these figures recently in the Navajo Times newspaper, in the kindergartens, where it really counts, it's down to about zero, which effectively means that if something isn't done soon, in 25 or 30 years, nobody's going to be speaking Navajo, which would be a tragedy on steroids, in my view. I mean, I hope, very much hope, that, you know, this beautiful and ancient language is going to be preserved and grow strong.
Wasn't there a reference to the Navajo language in the movie Finding Nemo?
I believe there was, but I'm not sure my grandchildren all watched Finding Nemo, but I didn't, so I'm afraid I was a bit out of
Well, the character, I don't know who it was, but Quentin Keene, it said that he brought some of the Navajo language into the movie, which is great. We just got to, you know, it would be great if it just spread out and people understood it more. But you said something earlier. You said you were... Blue Horse's chauffeur, basically, okay?
But you have bike carrier, yes.
You have some very interesting stories about going through checkpoints and being on the road with him. Could you share one of those stories, especially when at a checkpoint?
Well, this was, I think, when we went down to the border to buy peyote medicine. Is this one you're referring to?
Yes.
What happened was there's a place down on the border near Rio Grande City where there's six counties in that area of Texas where peyote grows. It's the only part of the United States where it grows. And Indians go down there to get peyote and bring it back. So Blue Horse and I went down there. This was supposed to be a sort of family trip, you know. Mm-hmm. In the end, only he and I went down there. And I was rather worried about this because the law that covers this is the 1993 Indian Religious Freedom Amendment Act, which I took care to consult before I left. And it makes it quite clear it is not illegal and it shall not be illegal, and no state will make it illegal for Indians, you know, to use peyote for traditional purposes. But it doesn't say anything about a white man driving the truck. And it's just coming Thanksgiving. And I'm driving along the border with 360 pounds of peyote medicine in the back of my car. I mean, it's not like you could easily miss it. You know?
Yeah, it's not like you have an ounce.
No, yeah, exactly. So I was getting quite jumpy, actually, because I was pretty clear, sure I wasn't doing anything illegal, but I'm not a lawyer. None of us were lawyers. Mm-hmm. And with it just coming Thanksgiving, I mean, I thought, well, if the Border Patrol's, you know, a policeman stops us and I'm not sure what to do about this, they're probably going to bun me in jail and just leave me there until after Thanksgiving and then let the judge sort it out, you know. Mm-hmm. Horrors of me and Blue Horse being thrown into some border prison, you know, for Thanksgiving. So in the end, my nerve cracked a bit. I think she read in the book, and I got quite paranoid that people were following us. And there was this one where I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll stop at this cafe, and I'll park my car in the car park, and I'll look through the window, see if anybody's watching it. I couldn't see anybody watching it. But then I thought, but these people are very clever, aren't they? They could be watching it, and I can't see them. At that point, I thought, get a grip, Charles. Come on.
Yeah, ultimate paranoia.
But, yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing that, my life became. I went from being the night news editor of the largest newspaper in Western Europe to being a very paranoid man with 360 pounds of peyote in the back of my truck on the American-Mexican border. So it's quite a transition.
Yeah, but Blue Horse had a way of getting past it, because when you guys were stopped and the cops said, are you Mexican? No, he goes, Indian.
Yeah, yeah, well, the thing is, I mean, we had the papers, right? Which said this is, you have to get some papers from your local, head of your local branch of the Native American Church, which Blue Horse had. I mean, it was all perfectly legal. For him, the problem was for me. But the Border Patrol and police and people, we kept being stopped, and they always thought he must be a Mexican, you see. So they kept speaking to him in Spanish, which annoyed him. Until we got stopped at one stop, right? And I was sort of getting out my driving license and so on. I've got my passport with me as well, because I'm not a U.S. citizen, so I got my passport with me. And then the officers looked at them, and he looked over at Blue Horse. He spoke in Spanish, and this time Blue Horse had had enough, and he thumped himself on the chest, and bang, and I was, Navajo Indian. And the officer was so taken aback, he said, oh, all right, off you go. Didn't even bother to look at his license or papers or anything. So.
And the dog smell it in the car.
It was a memorable trip. I'm sorry, I missed you there, one.
I said the dogs that were searching the cars didn't smell it, so you basically got through?
Well, yes, you see, I mean, look, the officers at that particular checkpoint, it was rush hour in Laredo, I think it was. I can't exactly remember. I think it was Laredo. They don't have time to search all the cars. I mean, there's just masses of cars building up. So they rely on sniffer dogs. But the sniffer dogs are only trained to sniff out things like, you know, heroin and cocaine and marijuana. I mean, they're not trained to sniff out peyote, which is perfectly legal. So I reckoned, you know, if the dogs didn't start barking at us, which they wouldn't, then we'd be in the clear. So
As you say in your book, the best way to hide something if you're going to do something is like prime time, broad daylight, massive traffic, just go for it, because less likely to get found out.
Yeah, this is the kind of thing you learn as a young reporter, you know, the pounding the rain-swept streets of North London. people who really smuggle things don't do it in the middle of the night, you know, when they're the only car on the road. They do it at, bright daylight at rush hour. If you want to move, not that I'm suggesting any of your readers would ever listen to
this. Of course not. Right.
And if you ever want to move something that you don't want anyone to know about, do it in rush hour, in broad daylight, when the number, proportion of officers, the proportion of people on the road goes down. So in fact, there are less officers and more people, so you got less chance of being stopped. I just passed that on for what it's worth.
Okay, folks, so you've heard it. Now, just to be clear, in case of someone who's listening who's not truly familiar with peyote, what is it and how does it affect you?
Well, now, I should make this very clear. I have only ever experienced peyote medicine under very strict conditions, which are the religious ceremonies that Navajo and other Indian tribes hold in which peyote is a central part. I've never tried or wished to try peyote, which is a very, very sacred plant to Indians. I can't stress that enough. It's a very sacred thing. And it is not to be messed about with, and it's certainly not to be used in any kind of recreational manner. It's only to be used in a very worshipful, very religious setting. One of these peyote medicine meetings, they go on all night. They go on for something like 12 hours, starting in the evening and working through to dawn and after dawn. And it's quite an ordeal, frankly. I mean, if you can imagine sitting cross-legged on the ground for 12 hours.
No.
It's not an easy thing to do, and stay awake all night, and pray, and sing. There are certain medicines, there's a drum that goes right inside the teepee when they're holding these ceremonies, and people sing. I mean, I sing medicine songs, but I sing them in Navajo. I don't know any in English. I've never heard one in English, quite frankly, so I just do it with Navajo. But the medicine is intended to help you break down the barriers between you and the infinite. I mean, a man called Quanah Parker, who was a Comanche, was the man who first brought the peyote ceremony to North American Indians. It's about in the 1890s. And Quanah was once asked, you know, what was the difference between his religion and white man's religion? And he said the white man goes into church and talks about God. The Indian goes into the teepee and talks to God. Okay. And that's a very big difference. And look, everybody's experience is probably different, and I can only talk about mine. But if you look in an encyclopedia or a dictionary, it will say that peyote is an hallucinogen. Now, I would deny that completely. You know, things like that in encyclopedias and books and reference books are written by people who have no personal experience of this at all. And they're copying it out of books written by people who also don't have any experience right down the line. And what I would say about the medicine is that it is not a hallucinogen. What it does is it allows you to experience another reality, a separate reality, but one that's just as real as the one that we're looking at now.
So would it be like going to another dimension? Just so you're clear.
Look, it's very, very difficult to describe. All sorts of things can happen. You see, look, if I can just roll back on this for a moment, this is standard science. Everything that you and I are experiencing at the moment, me listening to you, you listening to me, your listeners listening in, we're experiencing it because of chemical reactions in our brains, which allow us to see and hear and speak and experience things. It's a matter of simple chemical reactions. And, well, I say simple, they're very complex, but they're chemical reactions. It makes sense that if you change the chemical, you're going to change the reaction. And now I'm not pretending that I know how the medicine works, really, but it does seem to take you into another place. I'll give you some examples as best I can, and I can only, I mean, I'll prefigure this by saying that my words are completely inadequate to describe some of the things that happen.
Okay.
But, I mean, I tried in the book, and, you know, I read it again recently, and I just thought it was completely inadequate, but then words won't convey. There are times when the teepee, and most of these meetings are held inside a teepee, sometimes with the Navajo, they hold them in a hogan, which is a traditional earthen wood building. But there are times when the teepee seems to become a universe on its own, where there's nothing outside. You know, I'll look at the sides of the teepee and wonder, you know, is the ice age going on out there? Is there anything out there at all? You know, it doesn't seem like there's anything except the inside of this teepee, as if it's become a kind of universe on its, of its own. Just occasionally, I've had this very strange experience where I'm sitting there and I'm suddenly aware that some vast, enormous presence has entered into this teepee, as if you might be in the presence of God. And that's the only way I can express it, as a feeling of a massive, enormous presence has entered into the teepee. Now, that's one kind of experience you can have with it. Other times, I've had various visions. In my first book, Meeting the Medicine Men, I described how one night I turned into a fly, which is a very odd thing to turn into. But I was sitting there, and somebody was singing, and the drum was going, and they have this gourd rattle, which produces, I can't really produce it again verbally, but it's a very high-pitched sort of chink, 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 chink sound. And suddenly I realized I tuned into this rattle, and all I could hear was chink, chink. And the next moment, I turned into a fly, and I flew out through a hole in the hogan wall, tiny little hole. And the next moment, I was walking on the clouds, looking at the moon, and I could feel the wind on my face. I could actually feel the wind on my face as I was walking on the clouds. The next moment, I was back in the hogan. So, being the kind of investigative reporter that I once was, I immediately looked at where I'd flown out through the hole in the hogan wall, and there wasn't a hole there. So I thought, well, there, because it's just a show, doesn't it? You know, it's just all imagination. Blow me, Monique, and you can believe this or believe it not. As the dawn came up, I saw a little chink of light coming through exactly the point where I'd thought I'd flown out through the wall. There was a little hole there in the earth wall. And I thought, well, good heavens, you know, what is going on here? So after the ceremony had finished, I approached one of the medicine men there, and, you know, told him this story. And he kind of looked at me as if I'd sort of told him something as dramatic as I'd been to McDonald's a couple of days earlier or something. And he just, He said, well, what are you surprised about? He said, you know, the fly's part of the universe. You're part of the universe. Why shouldn't the fly become you or you become the fly? I mean, what's your problem, white boy, basically? I said, well, you know, I mean, how did I know the, when I was a fly, there was a hole in the wall, and when I was a man, I couldn't see one. He said, look, if you swipe at a fly, do you think the fly has time to think about it? You know, you swipe at a fly, it knows you're swiping at it before you started. That's why you never, very rarely have ever hit them. He said, the fly doesn't have time to think about a hole in the wall. He just knows there's one there. So he went straight through it. And he said, so when you were the fly, you knew the hole was there, even though you couldn't see it when you were a man.
So when you were a fly, you were trusting in your instincts.
Exactly.
And you just knew.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Okay. And so, you know.
Now, wait a minute, before you say anything else, let me ask a question. Was that like a shape shifting, or what was that when you morphed from human into fly and then back into human again?
Well, I mean, all I can tell you is that was my experience. But, I mean, there is shape-shifting among the Navajo, but it's not what I just described. I mean, what I just described was, you know, something that happened to me personally. Shape-shifting among the Navajo is a much darker, more evil thing.
Can we talk about that in Skinwalkers for a moment?
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
Sure. I mean, do you want to ask me a question, or do you want me to...
No, I don't mind your general, like, download of shapeshifters and what they are, and then also skinwalkers, because they are quite different.
Yeah. Among the Navajo, there's something called a skinwalker. And what that's a kind of Englishism. It's not... It doesn't mean the Navajos use a different name, which doesn't mean the same thing. But in English, it's skinwalker. And what that means is that somebody has changed into an animal or a bird. And what happens is that a medicine man... it doesn't have to be a medicine man, but it usually is, but it can be an ordinary person, basically sells themselves to the dark side for, you know, the money and prestige and something it can bring them. And that gives them the ability to turn into an animal or a bird, usually a quickly moving animal, something like a deer or a wolf. Or a bird like an owl. And they can then go very quickly around Navajo territory, basically doing evil deeds. And this shapeshifter, the skinwalker, is very, very widely believed. I mean, I've never met a Navajo. Well, actually, I've met one Navajo who didn't believe in skinwalkers. But when he confessed this to me, he then said, but shh, we're probably the only people for 50 miles around who don't, so I better keep quiet about it. indeed, a lot of white people who live around the reservation believe in skinwalkers as well. I've been present on, I think, two occasions when a skinwalker was said to have manifested itself, and the Navajos I was with assured me that there was a skinwalker on one occasion up on the ridge, and I can't remember where the other one was. I couldn't see anything, but they said there was one there. And on another occasion, a woman was pointed out to me. She was just sitting quietly, you know, near a sweat lodge, and she was pointed out to me as a skinwalker. You know, this is a tradition, you know, I should tell you, this is a tradition which actually has very deep roots in Europe as well. It's been almost forgotten now. but in fact, actually, the last vestige of it is the werewolf. You know, we all know about it, or much of that beloved in horror films, you know. But there was a very long, very deep European tradition of this, and it's probably best recorded by an Icelandic writer, Snorri Sturluson, who wrote down a lot of this stuff in about the 12th or 1300s, I think it was. And he had a hero in one of his books called Skallagrimsson, Grimson, and he was a shapeshifter. And he would turn himself into various animals and get out of locked rooms and things like that. But you see, like so much European tradition involving witchcraft and healing and things like this, it's all just been blown away. And we're left with basically nothing there. But I mean, the Navajo, these very, very ancient ideas are still current. And that's one of the joys of being there and being able to learn about these things and being able to study it.
Well, why are they so paranoid about, you know, like they think that someone's witching them? I think in the book you had a story of two girls. I don't remember if they were sisters or not, but they had been witched when they were in the water, and one had eczema, the other one had back problems, and Blue Horse, you know, went in to heal them. But they seem like so susceptible to the lower vibration energies. So is it kind of that it really exists, but they attract it to them because their thoughts are lower level energy regarding this?
I really can't answer that question. I'm not really sure. I mean, in the terms you're asking me, I don't really know. What I do know is that there are many things that the Navajo believe can cause illness and you know, general misery. And the medicine man's job is to kind of alleviate this, and he will do this divination ceremony. It's called various things. Some people call it crystal work. Some people call it a cedar ceremony. I tend to call it a cedar, in which you look into these red hot coals, which it's my job as his apprentice to bring in from a fire that I've lit outside.
Okay.
And he will try to find out what the trouble was. You know, he can look into the past and he will say things like, you know, well, you know, did you, I always remember this. We went to visit this guy. He got this terrible pain in the back of his neck. And it had come on quite suddenly, and he'd been to the hospital and they couldn't cure it. And it wasn't, Blue Horse kind of looked into the fire and he said, did you ever kill a snake? And that guy said, no. And Blue Horse said, are you sure? I said, oh, yeah. He said, when I was about 12, I was cleaning out the yard, and there was a snake in the yard, and I was feeling a bit fed up, didn't want to clean out the yard, so I got a hoe and I cut his head off. And Blue Horse said, well, that snake has now come back to haunt you. And because you cut its head off, it's now affecting you. It's getting you in the same place, and that's why the pain in your neck was so bad. It had to give up work. You know, it was really bad. So Blue Horse did some medicine, and he did some prayers, and he said, give it 4 days, because everything in Navajo goes into fours, but it takes 4 days for all this to get to the spirit world. And, he asked the Great Spirit and so on to intervene with the snake and to stop it hurting the man. I wasn't present when this happened, but Blue Horse told me later that the guy had phoned up and said the pain had gone.
Well,
so amazing. Happy ending to the story.
Yeah, well, there's another lady, though, that she had breast cancer, and I think this is, you went back to England for a while, and your parents had passed away, and then you decided to, like, release everything in your life, and then you came back to the United States. So tell us about the breast cancer, because that was a fascinating story in the book.
It is a fascinating story. Well, what happened was that we, Blue Horse and I were asked to go and see this lady who'd been told she had breast cancer, and she was told she was going to lose her breast. Mm-hmm. And she was told she was probably going to have to be operated on by the end of the week. So Blue Horse worked on her. I went there, you know, in my apprentice capacity and so on. And then I went back to England almost just a few days later. So I never found out what happened until about 2 years later when I bumped into this lady. And she told me, oh, it's marvelous. You know, Blue Horse worked on me and my cancer went, and I never had to have an operation. And it's just, you know, I haven't got cancer now, and it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. Now, I am not one to underestimate Blue Horse's powers, but that sounded pretty miraculous. Mm-hmm. So one thing I ought to tell you, I'm very rarely am I able to do a follow-up on patients and find out how things turn out. Usually you're relying on someone in the family to phone you and say, you know, everybody's mm-hmm. better now or whatever. Mm-hmm. But on this occasion, I was able to go and see her and talk to her about it. And it turned out, actually, that Blue Horse had done more work on her in the sweat lodge. They do a lot of healing in the sweat lodge while I'd been in England, so I didn't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. But also that she'd had chemotherapy and radiation therapy, I think. She told me she was now clear of cancer, and I'm sure that was correct. So what you see here is what you very often find about Navajos, that she's had the best that modern medicine can offer. Uh-huh. And I'm sure that did her a lot of good. But she's also had a lot of the traditional medicine. She's had the traditional healing. She's had people praying over her. She's had, you know, Blue Horse working on her to remove what Navajos call bad stuff out of her. And I'm quite sure, absolutely sure, that being able to fall back on these traditional Navajo ways mm-hmm. is something that gives Navajos tremendous extra strength in these situations. You know, people like, you know, white people like me, and probably many of you listeners, all we can do in these circumstances is probably read a book about it and pace mm-hmm. the carpet, maybe go to church and do some praying and so on. But the Navajos have a whole system of support. Mm-hmm. So the patient becomes, you know, whatever the effect of traditional medicine, whatever it may be, there's this tremendous support system that they can fall back on. And I think it strengthens them hugely when they're facing serious situations. And I think most doctors would tell you that patients who believe they're going to get better, believe they're fighting their illnesses, mm-hmm. believe they can be successful in fighting their illnesses, usually do better than those who don't. And I think this is one area where Navajos really have a big advantage over a lot of other people.
Mm-hmm. Now, could the Navajo ways work in the Western world if the Western world was more open to it?
I'm sure they would do no harm. Actually, if you go into the hospitals in Gallup in New Mexico, which is right on the edge of the reservation, mm-hmm. it's quite normal for the medicine man and the doctor to be working on the same patient. I mean, not at the same time, I should say. But, yeah, I mean, you know, the doctor will come in and do his stuff, and then the family mm-hmm. bring in the medicine man and bring him right into the hospital bed, and they'll do a healing ceremony right there in the hospital. This is quite common. And, I mean, Navajo medicine strictly adheres to one of the basic tenets of medicine, going right back to the ancient Greeks, you know, Hippocrates and so on. Mm-hmm. First, do no harm. And nobody has ever been harmed, I think, by having a Navajo medicine man praying over you, wafting cedar smoke over you with an eagle feather. They take a pipe. It's like a, if you can imagine sort of like a flute, but only about 6 inches of it. It's a hollow tube.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they'll actually suck the disease out of the patient. Nobody has ever come to any harm that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I read a recent study from Johns Hopkins University, which reckoned that something in excess of 200,000 people a year in the United States die from medical mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's putting it about the third leading cause of death in the United States, you know, after cancer and heart disease. I mean, it's a pity that there is such a casualty rate among people who go into hospitals and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, given that, you know, modern medicine is playing with such powerful drugs and, massively complicated operations, some kind of mistakes are going to be made. But that doesn't apply to Navajo medicine. Nobody ever got worse from being treated by a Navajo medicine man. And an awful lot of people, I have seen it with my own eyes, have got better, and very quickly too in some cases.
So can we as Westerners contact a Navajo medicine man and basically make an appointment to see them and have them work with us?
No.
Okay.
Medicine men, I mean, real medicine. Look, if you come to the Navajo reservation and wave enough money about, somebody will eventually introduce you to somebody who's claimed to be a medicine man.
Okay.
The chance of it being that person being a real medicine man are about zero.
Oh, okay.
You really, I mean, if you're an outsider, you really need to know somebody who knows somebody.
Okay.
And even then, they're really not keen to take white people on. And this is something, you know, I would hope would change in time. And I'm hoping that my books may help in this area.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think Navajo medicine men actually have a lot to offer. In many ways that we don't understand, or even I understand.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, recently I was contacted by a lady who was a lawyer in Toronto, actually, who read one of my books. And again, it was a case of breast cancer. She got this mass in her breast. Her doctor had told her, look, we've got to do the test, but I think you should prepare yourself for the worst.
Mm-hmm.
And Blue Horse worked on this lady. And he did it at a distance. He did it in the sweat. She was still in Canada, but he worked on her in the sweat. And they have a way of seeing evil in the stones that are brought into the sweat, the red hot stones, and taking it out. And he did the ceremony for her, and he said at the end of it, tell her everything's going to be okay. Right? He was absolutely definite about it. He said, tell her everything's going to be okay now. Well, you know, I should know better after all these years, but I was slightly dubious, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But I phoned her and I said, look, he tells me it's all going to be okay. And, you know, she went to the doctor, she had all the tests, and the doctor said, do you know, I could have sworn that was cancer, but actually it's not, it's benign.
Mm.
And when I told Blue Horse, he said, well, I told you, I took all the bad stuff out. So,
yeah.
You know.
Well, it's interesting how they can.
Many stories like that.
It's interesting how they can remove the disease, you know, from the body, and you see it. Did I read correctly that? Do I remember correctly that it was you who also had something taken out of your body?
Yes. Now that was really strange. I have this incredible pain in my shoulder. You know, I'm not a man who worries much about aches and pains, but I mean, this was just out of this. You know, just out of this world. I mean, at one point I was lying on the floor and I said to my wife, look, if this gets any worse, you're going to have to take me to hospital. I can't stand this anymore.
Uh-huh.
And it went off a bit. I didn't go to hospital, but it really hurt. And I was going down to see Blue Horse for a few days. I mentioned it to him and he said, well, let me take a look at it. And he did the cedar ceremony to try and see what the problem was. He said, well, you've been shot by a ghost arrow. He said, somebody, you know, one of these bad people. There were witches on, there were a lot of witches on the reservation.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, said someone shot you with a ghost arrow. They're trying to kill you with it, but I'll get it out for you. And he used his tube and he sucked away, and I actually could sort of feel this thing coming out.
Wow.
And when he showed me what he sucked out, it was a tiny, tiny little stone arrowhead, much, much smaller than any arrowhead you've ever seen. It was just tiny.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he said, that was it. He said, somebody shot you with that. And he said, you know, it'll hurt for 3 days, but on the fourth day, the pain will go away. And do you know, for 3 days, it was like walking around with an open wound. I mean, there was nothing, you know, you couldn't see anything, but it felt like mm-hmm. an open wound.
Mm-hmm.
And on the fourth day, it went, and it's never come back. I never had any recurrence whatsoever.
Wow.
So, you see, look, it's very, very difficult to figure out what's working here. And I go into this in some length in the book. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, my wife is a nuclear physicist. I mean,
mm-hmm.
she's probably one of the finest women physicists in this country and probably in the world. And, you know, we have conversations about this. But essentially, the models that physicists use to try to understand the universe do not work very well.
Mm-hmm.
They work a lot better if you add other forces in, which you can do mathematically. You know, this is all done by math. So you add in things, I think they're now up to 24 different dimensions.
Mm-hmm.
They can add in all sorts of strange forces which are affecting the universe, which you can't see. And, you know, nobody actually knows whether these exist or not, but you can do it all mathematically. And then their models of the universe work a lot better, and it all looks a lot better. Now, my model, in inverted commas here, model of Navajo traditional medicine would work a lot better if I added in occult forces, you know, spirit forces, witchcraft forces. I mean, it would all make it a lot easier to understand. And people often said to me, well, why don't you? I mean, you know, you see these things happening. Why don't you just say, oh, well, occult forces are at work?
Mm-hmm.
I have to be very honest with people. I can't prove that that is so. I cannot prove to you that there's some otherworldly force at work here.
Okay.
If it is, then Navajo medicine all makes a lot more sense, and it's far easier to understand how it works.
Mm-hmm.
And there may be. There may well be. But I can't prove it. This is the problem. And I think I say somewhere in the book that I hope that one day somebody, no, it may have been in the other book, actually, one day somebody a lot cleverer than me is going to come along and make sense of all this, and may well find forces that, you know, that I unfortunately can't prove.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a perfect statement to end our show on, because we're out of time. But, folks, we've been speaking with Charles Langley. His book is Spirit Lands, The Peyote Diaries of Charles Langley. Go out there and get it if you're interested in Navajo mysticism at all. It's a great book. It's an easy read. You're, like, transported through the story, but you get certain lessons out of it, and I found it to be very enlightening. So, you know, check it out at your local bookstore or, more importantly, online, I guess. So, Charles, thank you for being my guest tonight. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you very much for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
No problem. And thank you to the audience for being with us tonight as we collectively get over it and learn more about the Navajo traditions and Navajo medicine. I am truly honored and appreciate your time and attention. When you're ready to live a more balanced life, give me a call. Intuitive consultations are 30 minutes or longer are offered at a 10% discount if you mention the podcast. Love yourself enough to make an investment in yourself and make the call. 888-240-6057. And remember, the most important choice that you can make is what you choose to make important. Consider making the masterful choice of love. Abundant blessings, light, and love to all. Namaste.